Last month, a wrong-way interstate car crash killed two police officers and two others. This week, news that the Des Moines bar that served the drunk driver may face charges. It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Also this hour, what's keeping the legislature in session? We'll hear from IPR's Joyce Russell. The transition to private Medicaid management, 1 month on. A new University of Iowa study that asks whether tweets can measure happiness. One man walks across Iowa for male mental health. And a big payoff for an Iowa brother and sister who were inspired by Donald Trump's controversial woman card comment. Buckle up for your NewsBuzz. First, this news from NPR. It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Iowa lawmakers are back at the Iowa Capitol today. They're trying to wrap up the 2016 session. And Joyce Russell, Iowa Public Radio State House correspondent, joins us now to give us details on the hopeful wrap-up within the next few days. Joyce Russell, hi.
Hello.
I understand last night lawmakers failed to reach agreement on several key spending bills. Tell us what's going on.
Well, there are two things that are still in negotiation and preventing adjournment. They are both on budget bills. On the Human Services budget bill, there is a Republican effort to defund Planned Parenthood. This has been attempted in the past. It has delayed adjournment in the past. So that's one of the things that's holding things up. The other is just kind of an issue that just kind of came up out of the blue, the transportation appropriations bill. The governor requested, and DOT really wants, $10 million to cover raises and other salary requirements negotiated, you know, bargained raises for their workers. And they say that if they don't get this money, they'll have to lay off employees. And this is kind of stuff left over from last year when they raised the gasoline tax. Republicans say we're not going to raise people's salaries, take that gasoline tax increase and put it into salaries. The DOT says that gasoline tax goes directly to roads, and so it's more a matter of appearances.
Mm-hmm. Do you see them reaching common ground soon?
Well, I hope so. There is this, you know, what's going on at the Capitol right now is just all behind the scenes with negotiators trying to work that out. On the Planned Parenthood thing, there is some kind of compromise measure out there that would expand access to women's health services without actually defunding Planned Parenthood. So maybe that will be the ticket. I'm not sure what's going to resolve the salary deal.
Mm-hmm. Any other last-minute bills apart from the budget issues?
That's pretty much it. Senate Majority Leader Gronstall said we're 95% done. And most of the budget bills have been passed. These last few, those are the two issues that are really holding everything up. There's a few minor things that they're working through at the last minute.
Mm-hmm. The controversy at the Midwest Academy is something that got the attention of the legislature this session. Where does that end up?
Well, that conference committee was successful, and they came up with a compromise. The two parties disagreed on how religious institutions should be treated. This is all, as you say, it's all about coming up with some new regulation for private boarding schools that in general take in troubled children of one kind or another who aren't successful in regular schools. Midwest Academy was found to have been abusing children, and so they're coming up with some kind of regulation to prevent that. And the main disagreement between the two parties was how much freedom religious institutions should have in their curriculum in particular. But they came up with a compromise there. That's signed, sealed, and delivered.
Mm-hmm. Yesterday, Joyce, we devoted the entire hour to one of the notable failures of this session at the legislature, the failure of a compromise bill on medical marijuana. How much of a surprise is it that no medical marijuana legislation made it through this session?
I'm not really surprised. I think what gave everybody hope was that it was a Republican-sponsored bill in the House, which I believe was the first time for that. And so I think that's what really got the activists' hopes up. But it ran into the same fear and suspicion of opening up the use of marijuana. And in the end, it really succumbed to that, didn't make it out of the Commerce Committee. That was the interesting part that made people think, well, this is going to go somewhere. They're not putting it in the Law and Order Committee. They're putting it in the Conference Committee. But then it died in another or stalled in another mm-hmm. committee, and there were some last-minute attempts to do something. But the bill that the Republicans offered that would have expanded the number of conditions that a medical marijuana bill would cover, but still required people to go out of state to get it. And that bill didn't even have Republican support in the House. It was actually defeated in the House. So it was quite a blow to the families that, again, were very visible at the Capitol advocating for medical marijuana.
Mm-hmm. The outlook for the 2017 session, I would expect also based on my conversation with Senator Joe Bolcom yesterday, that this will be one of the priorities for the Democrats and perhaps some Republicans as well in the next session?
Yes, I expect the Democrats to stay on this. And, there is an election this fall, and there could be a different makeup in the House, and that could affect the outcome next year.
Mm-hmm. Water quality, Joyce, has been a major theme this session, spurred by the lawsuit filed by the Des Moines Water Works, also the governor's proposal this year to fund water quality. Where do we leave that at the end of this session?
Well, we leave that with continuing the same water quality programs that are out there, but coming up with no plan for significant funding long term, which is really what everyone agrees is going to be needed. The governor's plan would have eventually raised $4 billion. I mean, that's the kind of scale that we're talking about. But quite simply, the Republicans and Democrats could not agree on how to come up with that money. Basically, Republicans wanted to tap the money that's already out there. Democrats say, okay, you do that, then infrastructure and education and everything else suffers. You need to come up with a new funding source or use money that's surplus in the budget after everything else has been taken care of. And there wasn't. As Senator Gronstadt said, we're ships passing in the night. They weren't even really talking to each other.
Also, concerning the Des Moines Water Works, the board for the Des Moines Water Works, there was a suggestion that they should increase the number of board members. What's that about, Joyce?
Well, the Des Moines Water Works, as you know, is suing three Northwest Iowa counties over nitrates in the water. This has really riled up, really created an urban-rural conflict. Governor Branstad, very critical of the city of Des Moines. It's not the city, but it's the Water Works. And so there was an amendment. It didn't pass, but there was an amendment that would have expanded the people on the board of the Des Moines Water Works to take in some cases, some more rural areas or at least less Des Moines area dominating there.
Okay. Before we say goodbye, Joyce, your best guess on when the session will be finished up?
Well, I'm hoping that they're going to finish up this weekend. When they send everybody home and bring everybody back, number one, it costs some money.
Right.
And number two, once you come back, like if they were to come back on Monday, there's no way they would finish up on Monday. It has a way of eating up the whole week. So there's going to be a concerted effort to finish up this weekend.
Okay. Joyce Russell, Iowa Public Radio State House correspondent. Thanks for the update, Joyce.
Okay. Thank you, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Details emerging this week in the case of that tragic wrong-way crash that killed two police officers and two civilians last month. The Iowa Department of Public Safety reported Benjamin Beery, the driver who caused the crash, had a blood alcohol content nearly three times over the legal limit. Now, after an Iowa State Patrol investigation showed Beery was at the keg stand, that West Des Moines bar may face criminal and civil liability charges. Here to help explain the law in this case, Tony Goggin, Associate Professor of Law at Drake University in Des Moines. Tony, welcome back to the program.
Oh, thank you, Ben. It's a pleasure to be here.
So tell us, what does Iowa law state about liability for a bar in this case when it comes to driving under the influence?
Well, Ben, Iowa is one of many states that have what's called a dram shop law. And what a dram shop law does is it provides a right of recovery for any person who's injured by an intoxicated person who became intoxicated when they went to a bar or restaurant and were overserved. Now, the key legal standard is the plaintiff has to show that the bartender or the server at the restaurant knew that the person they were serving, the intoxicated person, was intoxicated or was about to become intoxicated because of the alcohol that was served to them. So essentially, this comes down to a question of whether or not, in this case, the drunk driver was obviously intoxicated when they were at the keg stand, and so a reasonable bartender or server would have recognized that this person should have been cut off. And that really is a fact-specific inquiry, one that will ultimately depend on the evidence that the plaintiff's able to produce.
Mm-hmm. With three times over the legal limit for drunken driving, I guess I don't know. Can you walk out of a bar with that much alcohol in your system and not make it apparent to others that you're actually really pretty wiped out?
Well, it's interesting. In this case, apparently there was security video, and that was part of the Iowa State Patrol investigation. And I would expect that that video will be very closely scrutinized by all the attorneys involved. I should add, at least as of yet, there has not been a lawsuit filed.
Mm-hmm.
However, the bar has enlisted the assistance of counsel in anticipation of the lawsuit. And there's one other wrinkle here, which is that under Iowa's dram shop law, bars or restaurants are required to, in advance, get insurance for precisely these types of lawsuits, because the idea is we want to make sure that if somebody is injured as the result of an intoxicated person being overserved at a bar or restaurant, that that injured person will be able to recover not only a legal judgment against the bar or restaurant that overserved the intoxicated person, but will also actually be able to recover financially.
Mm-hmm.
Because in many cases, these damage awards could be in the millions of dollars, particularly in this case, where we're looking at three fatalities, the two police officers and the person who's being transported by the police officers. And so this is a situation where you really need an insurance carrier with deep pockets to be in a position to actually compensate the families of the victims.
Do we know that a regular bar, normally has such insurance?
Yes, normally they do because they are required to. It's usually attached to the process of actually getting a liquor license,
mm-hmm.
and the law requires that.
Okay, so as you mentioned, no charges filed thus far, but it was announced that there could be criminal and civil charges. The difference here between civil and criminal charges in this specific case would be?
Well, normally we see civil actions because the burden of proof is much higher in a criminal case. Beyond a reasonable doubt, it's a very high standard. Whereas in a civil case, you just have to show that the preponderance of the evidence shows that a reasonable bartender in these facts would have realized they're serving a person who's intoxicated or about to become intoxicated. So normally, these cases proceed as civil cases.
Mm-hmm. Are there any big precedents that will be used by those bringing this case if it comes to be?
Well, the law is clear that injured the families of victims can certainly bring a lawsuit here. And so there's no question what the law is. The question in this case really will just come down to, will the plaintiffs be able to show that the bar in question in this case had evidence that the person who was being served was intoxicated?
Mm-hmm.
So this really will come down to what the witnesses say who were at the bar and whatever the video is able to show about the 6 hours in question before the drunk driver got into their vehicle and tragically got out onto the interstate.
Someone defending, an attorney defending the bar, the keg stand in this case, would likely have what counter arguments?
Well, they're going to, I think any defense will be ultimately based on the burden of proof. They're going to attempt to show, at least most attorneys in the situation would attempt to show, that there aren't enough facts to support the conclusion that the bartender would have known that the person they were serving was intoxicated. And so it really will turn on what the witnesses testify to if this actually gets to trial. I would add, in most cases like this, when there are a lot of witnesses, the cases normally settle because the insurance carriers have a strong incentive in settling these types of lawsuits. But if the evidence isn't clear one way or the other, that would increase the likelihood that you'd actually go to trial and let the jury resolve it.
Tony, before we let you go, a question on another case in the news. This week, the governor announced that the application process for felons trying to regain their right to vote in Iowa has been streamlined, a significant number of questions eliminated. This is an announcement that comes less than a month after Iowa's policy on felons voting faced some scrutiny from the American Civil Liberties Union and other groups in a major voting rights case argued before the Supreme Court. We spoke with you about that case. So what's the connection? Was that case the leverage for action, this new streamlined process?
Ben, I think this case definitely raised the public profile of the whole issue of ex-felons voting rights. And so I think pressure has been building on the governor's office to create a more streamlined process. But I would add, it really doesn't matter what the governor's office does at this point, because it is the broader constitutional issue is in the hands of the Iowa Supreme Court. And at the moment, it certainly is possible that the Iowa Supreme Court is going to hold that the Iowa Constitution only disfranchises a very small percentage of felons, those who commit politically related crimes. And if that's the case, then the whole process of felons having to apply for a restoration of their voting rights will only apply to a very small number of people.
Mm-hmm. And that decision expected?
This is a case in which it appears the court is divided, and so I would expect there will be extensive opinions written both by the majority and the dissent, and that would suggest we're probably looking at June at the earliest before we get a ruling.
Okay, thank you very much, Tony Goggin, Associate Professor of Law at Drake University, for keeping us informed with your analysis of this case, these cases before going on here in Iowa. Tony, thanks again.
My pleasure, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Quick conversations on our Fridays to wrap up the week, to get to some news items that we didn't otherwise get to in our talk shows during the week. Just over a month ago on this program, we talked with patients and providers alike about the impending switchover of Medicaid in Iowa into private management. Now, that switchover, if you remember, happened at the beginning of this month. The health care program Medicaid, as a reminder, is for low-income Iowans, and it currently has more than 560,000 recipients in the state. One of those recipients is Heather Young. We talked with her a while ago. Now we want to talk with her again to discuss how that first month of the process has gone for her family. Heather Young, welcome back to the program.
Glad to be here.
Now, we want to remind our listeners that your family has three generations of Medicaid recipients, a daughter. You're the daughter of two elderly, low-income parents with some mental health issues. You're the mother of three college students. They have some hearing and vision losses. And you're the grandmother of a three-year-old daughter who has autism. Tell us, how has the first month for you been under private management in these cases?
Well, it's been a little bit bumpy. My granddaughter, one of the clinics that she received services from at the university, told me that they're having trouble already, because people who otherwise would have received services in private clinics, those private clinics are not part of the managed care system now. And so those people are now having to come to the University of Iowa to receive services. Because the University of Iowa healthcare system is a public system, they have to accept Medicaid, Medicare, you know, programs that other places don't have to. So within this month, they've already seen a glut of more patients than the system can handle,
mm-hmm.
where my granddaughter received some services. So the waiting list is going to get ever longer, and the pipeline is narrowing. And that's my granddaughter. And then for my mother-in-law, who also receives Medicaid services, she got sick, and my husband and I were in the ER with her at the University of Iowa for 16 hours.
Mm. Would that have been different under different management? Did management make a difference in terms of hours,
well,
you think?
Yes, it did, because previous to the switchover, my mother-in-law's provider was different, and she would have gone to another hospital. But because of the switch, her provider has changed. The provider now is at the University of Iowa, which is great. Love the University of Iowa. They're good people doing good work. But when we were there, it wasn't just that we were there for 16 hours. It was that there was wall-to-wall beds in the hallways. There were people, there was not nearly enough beds. And we were told by the staff that this is now a regular occurrence, 3 to 4 days a week at the ER. They are beyond capacity. Mm-hmm. And it was tragic. There was a young man right outside my mother-in-law's room who was having a full-on psychotic breakdown, and there was nowhere for him to go. And there was no beds in the hospital, no mental health services anywhere in the state. They had to call the police. It was tragic.
Mm-hmm. Amy McCoy is the public information officer for the Iowa Department of Human Services, Heather. She couldn't join us today, but she provided this statement. This is a big transition for the Medicaid program and the 600,000 Iowans who receive coverage, writes Amy McCoy. While most members aren't experiencing issues as they move to a new health care plan, we know there are members who need additional support, and we want to hear from them so we can help them right away. We continue closely monitoring this transition, and we look forward to sharing more information with members about new value-added services and ways to achieve better health, such as completing health risk assessments and connecting with primary care provider for regular checkups. She goes on to write, we have information available for Medicaid members and providers, including videos, handbooks, desk aids, and more at www.iahealthlink.gov. And also, Amy McCoy stressed in a discussion with our producer, Claire Roth, that patient experiences can vary greatly depending on the circumstance. Another guest from last month's program, Carol Krotz, said that with the exception of some communication issues with her MCO, her transition has been relatively smooth. And we want to reach out to our listeners and say, if you have some stories of the Medicaid transition, it's personally affecting you, please tweet us at IPRTalk, tweet us at IPRTalk, or email us river2river@iowapublicradio.org. Before we go, Heather Young, how has communication been for you between and sort of getting rid of these wrinkles?
I don't know. The thing you just read from the official, that's all news to me. Didn't hear, haven't gotten any of that literature. Don't even know what she's talking about. Awesome to find out that it's on the internet. Didn't get an email. No one notified us it was even there. But I guess like everything else in Medicare and disability world, for parents and providers, the rule of thumb has always been the burden is on us to search it out and find the resources. The programming has never really worked in terms of being easily accessible. So I'm not really surprised that there's an official statement about how awesome this all is and how great it all is and how there's all this information. Too bad no one in the real world is getting that. But,
okay.
You know, that's not unusual.
Heather Young, thank you for your perspective. Heather Young, family has 3 generations of Medicaid recipients. We'll check back with others in the future. Coming up in just a moment, a new study that asks whether tweets can measure happiness. Also, a big payoff for a brother and sister here in Iowa who were inspired by a controversial Donald Trump remark this week. And one man walks across Iowa for male mental health. That's coming up in just a moment. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. We'll be walking on in the second half after a short break. I'm Ben Kiefer. And we're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Coming up, one man walks across Iowa for male mental health. Toward the end of a program, we'll talk about a big payoff for an Iowa brother and sister who were inspired by some controversial remarks by Donald Trump, the remark he made this week about the woman card. And we'll find out about that at the end of this hour. But first, does the use of social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, make us more or less happy? That's a question that's been at the heart of a lot of social science research. But research at the University of Iowa are using social media as a tool to examine whether or not we're happy in the first place. A study published in last month's Plus One examined whether tweets were an accurate measurement of someone's life satisfaction, happiness. One of the study's authors, Padmini Srinivasan, is a professor of computer science at the University of Iowa. She joins us now. Padmini Srinivasan, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
You are a professor of computer science at the University of Iowa, and I understand you've been using a lot of Twitter data to look at this. What data did you examine along with the lead author is Chao Yang. He's a former graduate student that you worked with here at the University of Iowa.
That's right. Chao was the PhD student on the project, and we looked at 2 years of Twitter data, and we developed an algorithm to find all the tweets that expressed something about life satisfaction, either on the positive side or on the negative side. And we analyzed them, and we tried to see what characteristics differentiated between those people who posted that they were satisfied and those who posted that they were not.
Mm-hmm. So this is roughly how many tweets you ran through this algorithm?
We had 4 billion tweets over the 2-year lifespan, but it's actually a small number. Mm-hmm. Because we were collecting only tweets that were in the first person, because we wanted to have some better odds of having it be a self-reflection of assessment of life satisfaction.
So not just any old sentence with happy in it or satisfied.
Oh, no, no.
We
developed a very an algorithm which is very different from the run-of-the-mill algorithm, which uses something called machine learning classifiers. And we actually went back to some of the old work and decided to derive a methodology which came from a very well-respected scale called the Satisfaction with Life Scale. And this was designed by Ed Diner in the mid-80s, and it is very well respected. And said, okay, how do we design a surveillance strategy from this scale? And so we did that, and we came up with a template-based retrieval methodology that actually retrieved the tweets that were saying something on life satisfaction.
Mm-hmm. And so what conclusions did you reach after going through this enormous amount of data?
Oh, interesting conclusions. The first thing is that life satisfaction is a cognitive assessment. So you look back in your life and say, okay, does it feel good or not? So it doesn't fluctuate quickly. It stays, you can change your mind, but it's relatively stable. And no one tells you how to make this assessment. So it's very different from affect, which is something that other researchers have studied. Affect is daily emotions. And so it fluctuates based on whether it's July 4th or New Year and so on. But in our case, the trends that we found were very stable. And that was a great observation, and it made me happy to see that.
Mm-hmm.
Another observation is that dissatisfied people are really posting more on anger, on sadness, on depression, on anxiety, and negativity on health and family and social support. And so we did not find that in the users who posted life satisfaction.
Mm-hmm. Did you look at it through the lens of regions in the country or countries in the world who's happier?
Yes and no. I mean, we did some of that analysis, but the data is not very lending. It doesn't lend itself to geographical pinpointing as well as we'd like it to. So we did not stress that aspect at all.
Mm-hmm. So with the conclusions of this study, what's the takeaway here, and what studies might this lead to?
The big takeaway is that social media data can give you sensible observations. The observations we made are intuitively reasonable, and they're supported by research in the social sciences. So I would like to have researchers consider social media data as, even though it's slanted towards a certain segment of the population, mm-hmm. it still gives very decent observations. And so that's a big takeaway. The second takeaway is that it pays to build an algorithm that is sound, that can actually pick a signal which is in less than 0.5% of the data that streams across. Mm-hmm. So it's a very hard problem. So the more you invest in the methodology, the better off you are.
So it's really the key coming up with this algorithm was the key here.
I think so. And so when the algorithm, the tweets gave us these nice observations, we were really taken aback. We didn't expect this, but we got sensible observations, and that was amazing. Mm-hmm. So
isn't an algorithm like this something you would mm-hmm. continue to tweak?
Yes, in fact, we want to, you know, it starts from a very well, in a principled way, from a very well-respected survey. So the next thing we want to do is take another survey and see if we can use roughly the same approach to come up with a surveillance strategy for a different problem. So we can take the depression scale or something else and use the same approach to come up with the surveillance strategies, come up with a parallel algorithm, if you may.
Mm-hmm. What are the practical applications for this? Will we be able to, have such algorithms assess our happiness, or what do you think? You're smiling I ask that question.
Yeah, because it's a good question. What we observed is that we also observed changes in assessment over time, and there are those people who say they're satisfied and stay the same throughout the 2-year span, and there are those who start satisfied and change to dissatisfied, and we found characteristics that differentiate between these two groups. The ones who change to dissatisfied express more anger, more anxiety, more sadness, more depression, and so on. That's not there in those who stay stable. Now look at that. So we observe these differences. So maybe, just maybe, there is a potential for some intervention or some, I don't know, I'm not going there. I'm not a social scientist necessarily. I'm not a psychologist and such. But maybe there's some signals there that could be exploited.
Interesting. We'll have to follow the research. Fascinating research. Padmini Srinivasan is a professor of computer science at the University of Iowa, part of a study along with the lead author, Chao Young, former graduate student at the University of Iowa's Computer Science Department. Thank you for enlightening us on this study now published just recently. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, and I want to say hello to my students.
All right. It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Still to come, an Iowa brother and sister get a big payoff when they launch a Kickstarter campaign inspired by that Donald Trump comment this week that Hillary Clinton is playing the woman card. But first, men die by suicide 3 times more often than women do. And clearly related, men are far less likely to seek help for depression. Mark Minear is a licensed psychologist at the Des Moines Pastoral Counseling Center. Mark is currently crossing the state by foot, walking Iowa's Highway 30 from river to river in an attempt to support underinsured men's and boys' mental health. Mark Minear, we're catching you during your walk. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Ben. It's great to be on. I'm at the Chit Chat Cafe in Ogden, Iowa.
Ogden, Iowa. So which way are you crossing the state, east to west?
I'm headed west. Right.
You're headed west, and so that means you're in Ogden. How far have you completed? How far do you have left to go?
Well, let's see. It's a total of about 342 miles. I'm trying to walk on the original Old Lincoln Highway as much as possible. And I think I've come about 215 or 220, something like that.
Okay. So you're over the hump, so to speak, perhaps.
I hope so.
Tell us about why you're doing this. Why doing this, and why are you doing it now in April?
Well, I probably have both professional and personal reasons to do it. And professionally, as you mentioned, I'm a psychologist at the Des Moines Pastoral Counseling Center trying to raise awareness about that men have mental health needs too. You already outlined the two most compelling statistics, I think, that men, for whatever reason, we've been socialized, I guess, are less likely to reach out for help when they're in trouble with their mental distress or emotional angst. Unfortunately, men are also more likely to end their suffering by taking their own lives. So those two have me going. I think at any given time, there's probably 6 million men in the United States that are probably depressed, and in over half of those situations, it goes unrecognized and undiagnosed and untreated. So that's partly what I'm doing, is raising awareness, but also trying to raise some funds. At the Des Moines Pastoral Counseling Center, we try to not turn anyone away, provide opportunity for counseling support for anyone, including the underinsured or the uninsured or those with inadequate mental health coverage. And so I'm trying to raise a few dollars to support our counseling assistance fund and make that available to men who might not come otherwise.
Mm-hmm. You're particularly concerned with trauma. Can you give us an example of the struggles some of the people you're hoping to reach face?
You know, I have a history of working with older men who've never come to counseling. They've carried around trauma from childhood. I've worked with veterans who have struggled with trauma from war. And, of course, they have found ways to cope along the way, a lot of them by being workaholics or whatever it might be to avoid all of that emotional pain. And somehow it catches up with some of them in later life. And so, man, I've worked with a lot of men who come in, you know, in their 50s, 60s, and 70s for the first time because somehow that trauma is now coming out in some anxious way, something counterproductive or debilitative in their life.
Mm-hmm. So. You're about two-thirds of the way through this walk from east to west, this walk across Iowa on Highway 30 to raise awareness here. How will you know that this has been worth it, that you've done some good here?
You know, I've thought about that. I have a lot of time to reflect in the quiet moments walking along the side of the road. And I think I told myself if one man were to call up to talk to Carol, our counseling, our intake coordinator there at the Des Moines Counseling Center, and said, I heard this guy on the radio and, you know, I think I need to come in and talk to someone. I think I'm going to count that a success.
I certainly would, Mark.
I do have a goal of raising at least $10,000 to see if that would be of benefit to those who need such support.
But before we say goodbye, Mark, and let you continue walking, tell us how people can find out more about this walk and the cause you're out there for.
Probably the easiest way is to go to our website, which is dmpcc.org. That's the Des Moines Pastoral Counseling Center.org. And they can click on a link there that says Walk with Mark, and that'll show you my daily blogs and if you want to make a donation and all of those kinds of things. So that would be wonderful. I think I love the state. I was born and raised in Iowa, and walking from river to river, prevailing upon the goodwill, I guess, of Iowans along the way, whether it's a bottle of water they've given to me or a donation they've handed to me out the window of a car or just maybe donations they would send to the center would just be amazing.
Okay. So. Thank you very much, Mark Menier, a licensed psychologist at the Des Moines Pastoral Counseling Center, crossing the state on foot to support men and boys' mental health, currently on Highway 30 in the area of Ogden, Iowa. Mark, good luck with the rest of your walk.
Thank you so very much.
And finally on this News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, a payoff for an Iowa brother and sister who were inspired, if that's the right word, by this comment made by Donald Trump a few days ago.
Well, I think the only card she has is the woman's card. She's got nothing else going. I don't think she'd get 5% of the vote. The only thing she's got going is the woman's card. And the beautiful thing is women don't like her, okay? And look how well I did with women tonight, okay?
Okay, Donald Trump, of course, talking about Hillary Clinton. Hillary Clinton's response to Trump's comments?
Mr. Trump accused me of playing the, quote, woman card. Well, if fighting for women's health care and paid family leave and equal pay is playing the woman card, then deal me in.
Okay, joining me now in the studio, Zebby and Zach Walls. They are creators of the woman cards, and this is an idea we want to find out about here in the next few minutes. Zach and Zebby, welcome to the program.
Good to be here.
Thank you.
Tell us how this happened. On the heels of Donald Trump's comment there, Hillary Clinton's response, what was the idea you had and how did you get it?
Yeah, so we had this big string of primaries on Tuesday night, and then after they were all done, Donald and Hillary were giving some speeches, and Donald had that line about the woman card. And Zebby is an art student at the University of Iowa. She was doing some sketches, and the next morning, on Wednesday morning, it all just kind of came together, and we had the kind of bolt of inspiration, and Zebby and I sat down and started figuring out what this might actually look like to put together a playing deck of cards of American women who have really changed this country.
Mm-hmm. So your job, and you can see this at your Kickstarter campaign website, Zebby, you've got two sort of mock-ups. I don't know if these will be the end result. You've got...
No, they're still very rough.
Okay, so we have Hillary Clinton as the Queen of Hearts, and we have Beyonce as...
So Hillary's the Ace of Hearts, and Beyonce is the Queen of Diamonds.
Okay, sorry, I got those mixed up. Okay, so this is the initial idea, only a few days old. Mm-hmm. How's the Kickstarter campaign doing? You launched this how many hours ago?
Literally 25 hours ago, almost to the minute. We were hoping to raise $5,000 by the end of May. We raised $5,000 in about 3.5 hours yesterday afternoon. So we've blown past our goal. I think we're coming right up on $20,000, hopefully sometime today.
Okay, so these cards will be made.
The cards are going to be made.
Definitely going to be made.
Yep, and it's going to be a lot of work on Zebby's part.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so let's talk about it. You have for a deck of cards, if you want to feature great American women, as you do in this case, how are you going to choose the women? 13 you're limited to, Zebby.
Yeah, that was really the most difficult part of all of this. I mean, we started initially just spitballing some ideas, and we quickly realized that if we were going to do an international group of women, that would just be way, way too hard to narrow down to 13. So,
I mean, not that choosing only 13 American women was a whole lot easier.
That much easier, yeah.
Right,
no, I mean,
right.
It made the job like slightly easier, but only slightly.
Yeah.
Because there have just been so many incredible American women who have impacted this country.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to get into different fields and science, politics, all different kinds of fields? Or what are the criteria you're
using
here?
Yeah, so something that was really, really important for us in choosing these women was we wanted to reflect America. And so we wanted to include a very diverse group of women in a diverse group of fields with a diverse group of interests. And really just be able to represent America in that way.
And I think the hope is, you know, for this first deck, our first edition, it's only going to be 13 women. Each woman will appear in all four suits, and then we'll have obviously the Jokers. So it will be a full 54-card deck like you would get, you know, at any normal deck of cards. And then the hope is that for future decks, potentially you could have 52 different women. We've thought about different fields like arts and athletics, science, politics and religion, humanitarian work, business. We are absolutely open to suggestions for that next deck. You can email us at thewomancards@gmail.com. You can also find us online at www.thewomancards.com. Mm-hmm. And you can leave us a comment on our website. We have a running list of suggestions. We've received already almost 100 different names of women to include on a potential second edition. So, you know, we're taking it one step at a time. We want to make sure that we're able to deliver this first set of decks in July, which is what we're shooting for. If we were going to do the full 52 women, unfortunately, that would essentially quadruple the amount of time that Zebby would have to spend drawing. And she has finals until next week. So we're working on a short timeline here as it is.
Obviously, the jumping off point here, a very partisan comment in what is going to be probably a nasty fight right up until November here. Is this in any way a partisan project you have going here? Do you want to say something about Zebby, about Donald Trump's comments here?
I think it's less of a statement on Donald Trump's comments on women and more like a celebration of American women, you know, everywhere and throughout history. I think that it's much more... What we're focusing on is the positives and all of the wonderful things that American women have been able to accomplish.
And that they've been able to accomplish, and pardon the pun, but with the deck stacked against them. And this project is in no small part about reshuffling the deck.
Mm-hmm. Tell us, Zach, perhaps you could share your thoughts about gender in this election cycle and the way it's been thrown back and forth.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm old enough that I remember 2008. I was a journalist for the West Side Story, Iowa City West High School's student newspaper, and I remember covering Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. And in the 2008 election cycle, I remember that Hillary did not talk about her gender very much. She really just tried to run a very gender-neutral campaign, and she was attacked for it. And she was told, you know, she's trying to pretend that she's not a woman. She's trying to avoid talking about the fact that she'd be the first woman president. And then this time around, she's actually embracing it, and she's talking about it more transparently. She was asked in one of the first debates what would be a big difference between you and Barack Obama. And she said, well, there's a big obvious difference, the fact that she's a woman. And this time, she's being accused of playing the gender card, the woman card. And so... you know, I think it's a good illustration of the double bind, how difficult it is for women kind of no matter what they do because of the restrictions that are placed, you know, if she talks about gender, she's breaking the rules. If she doesn't talk about gender, she's breaking the rules. And so I hope that this project, you know, is not explicitly just about Donald Trump or partisan politics, but that it is about, you know, the importance of acknowledging everything that women have done in this country.
Zach, for the listeners who may not know, you're the author of a very successful book, My Two Moms, tells about your upbringing in Iowa City as the son of two lesbians. You're now an activist in so many ways on behalf of LGBT equality. It all started with that short address mm-hmm. that went viral at the Iowa legislature back in, what, 2011?
2011, 5 years ago.
Okay. You've been on a roller coaster ever since then. How do you see your role in LGBT activism very quickly as we wind up?
Well, I'm still on the board of directors with Scouts for Equality, which is continuing to encourage the Boy Scouts of America to continue to enact its change in policy. Last summer, they ended their ban on gay adults, finally. But now, changing the policy is only the beginning. There's still a lot of work to do in changing the culture, and that's what Scouts for Equality is focusing on.
Okay, tell us, as we finish up, how do people find out more about the woman cards that are on this Kickstarter campaign? Perhaps people want to get a deck.
Yeah, absolutely. You can buy a deck at www.thewomancards.com. There's a lot of information about the project, the women involved, and how you can get involved.
Okay. Zach and Zebby Walls of Iowa City, creators of the Woman Cards. And, we'll hear more about that in the future, I'm sure. Thank you very much, Zebby and Zach.
Thank you so much.
River to River is produced by Claire Roth, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. Also help from John Pemble. Catherine Perkins is our executive producer. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us, and have a great weekend. Thank you.